This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Dennis, mailbox 3030. I'll be reading the Wall Street Journal report for today. Today is May 1st. We'll start as we normally do with the results of yesterday's performance. Stocks slip, extending April pullback. The subtitle is Indexes Finish Downbeat Month Ahead of Fed Meeting, Jobs Data. Stocks ended their worst month of the year on another low note. The S&P 500 fell 1.6% on Tuesday. The NASDAQ Composite lost 2%, while the Dow Jones shed 570 points, or 1.5%. All 11 S&P 500 sectors finished the day in the red. The broad index fell 4.2% in April, its worst performance since September, after posting its best first quarter performance since 2019. The NASDAQ and Dow dropped 4.4% and 5% respectively for the month. The Federal Reserve's campaign to lower inflation still has a way to go. Fresh data on worker compensation suggested Tuesday. The Labor Department's Employment Cost Index rose by a seasonally adjusted 1.2% in the first quarter from the previous 3 months and 4.2% from a year earlier. The market is obviously not taking the wage pressure well, said John Lynch, Chief Investment Officer at Comerica Wealth Management. The data, he said, completely gets the inflation discussion back on the table. It was the latest piece of data suggesting that inflation is still running hotter than the central bank would prefer. Consumer prices have increased more than Wall Street had expected for 3 months in a row. That trend has dimmed Wall Street's hopes for interest rate cuts in the near future. Investors entered the year expecting as many as 6 cuts in 2024, and now many doubt that there will be any cuts at all. Fed officials are expected to hold their benchmark federal funds rate steady at its highest level in more than 2 decades at its policy meeting, which concludes Wednesday. On Friday, April jobs data will offer a fresh look at the state of the labor market. The benchmark 10-year Treasury yield settled at 4.683% Tuesday, up from 4.612% Monday and 4.192% on March 28th. It was the largest monthly increase in yields since September of 2022. Bond prices fall when yields rise. Earnings season has been a relatively bright spot amid the recent gloom. S&P 500 companies are growing first quarter earnings by 3.9%, according to FactSet, when blending actual results with analyst forecasts. About 53% of companies within the index have reported results as of Tuesday morning. Amazon.com, the latest of the Magnificent Seven tech stocks to report, announced profits that topped expectations after markets closed Tuesday. Apple's results are due Thursday afternoon. I would say across the board that the earnings season has been good enough to support and justify where we are, said Nicole Webb, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor at Wealth Enhancement Group. Eli Lilly rose 6% after the maker of popular weight loss drugs increased its full-year profit outlook. 3M rose 4.7% after announcing it would scrap its quarterly dividend. GE Healthcare Technologies fell 14% after earnings, its worst single-day performance since its 2022 stock market debut. Gold futures rose 3.3% in April to settle at $2,291.40 per troy ounce. Crude oil futures fell 1.5% in the month to $81.93 a barrel. And that's a brief wrap-up of yesterday's performance. Interesting article as to how the upcoming election may have an effect on things. Taxes, tariffs, and debt, Holden. Investors start to fear the presidential election. Subtitle is Investors are weighing what the Biden-Trump rematch could mean for their portfolios. Financial advisor Matthew Wilson recently got a frantic email. A client wanted to dump their stock holdings as soon as possible. The reason? Stocks had staged a big run-up in recent months, and the client was worried that the market was about to get rocky heading into the presidential election in November. During an in-person meeting, Wilson said he was able to convince them to stay in the market. Vote with your vote, don't vote with a trade, said Wilson, a managing director at Roseville Wealth Management Group. Around the country, investors are getting jittery about the coming rematch between President Biden and former President Donald Trump. Many are peppering their financial advisors with questions about what the contest will mean for their portfolios. On Wall Street, strategists have been trying to sketch out the implications of a blue or red win on stocks, interest rates, and oil prices. The U.S. presidential and congressional elections this fall stand to be among the most consequential in a generation, wrote a team of BNP Paribas led by its chief U.S. economist, Carl Riccadonna. Fueling the nerves are the dramatically different decisions Biden or Trump could make on everything from immigration to who leads the Federal Reserve, and even how the central bank is run. The next president would also steer the U.S. through a time of heightened global tensions, with escalating conflicts in the Middle East and the continuing war between Russia and Ukraine. One point of focus for investors, the Trump administration's tax cuts, which will lapse after 2025. Already, the government's spending and the accompanying deluge of Treasury issuance has been making investors anxious. The BNP team said a Republican sweep of the White House and Congress would likely lead to an extension of tax cuts for individuals and a wider deficit. Of course, any implications for the deficit would be shaped by the mix of spending and cuts that lawmakers agree on. Biden, for example, has said he would extend some Trump-era tax cuts. The yield on 10-year Treasury on the 10-year Treasury note recently hovered at 4.612%, up sharply for the year, in part because of the wave of bond issuance and stickier-than-expected inflation. Even after a rough patch for markets in April, traders appear more anxious about this fall's election than they did about the coming weeks. In the derivatives market, traders have been paying more to protect against a stock market decline around November, a sign of heightened fear about the election, data from FactSet tied to CBOE Volatility Index show. In a 62-page report this year, BNP Paribas strategists and economists laid out multiple scenarios tied to how the election would shape power in the White House and Congress, as well as how leaders might influence everything from fiscal policy to clean energy and tariffs on China and Mexico. During Trump's presidency, for example, the U.S. dollar swung wildly against the Mexican peso based on Trump's tweets about tariffs on the country. Still, investors might be fooling themselves if they think they could predict the path of any asset based around the election. In 2016, some investors feared a Trump win would jolt markets. It did, momentarily. Stocks swooned overnight while the election results trickled in before staging a U-turn the following day and kicking off one of the biggest stock rallies in the wake of a presidential election. Investors seemed to love Trump's tax cuts and promise of deregulation. In 2020, some investors worried that a murky election result could stoke stock market mayhem for months. The S&P 500 ended up soaring around 11% from Election Day in November through the end of the year. Stock volatility isn't unusual around an election, but once the uncertainty passes, stocks typically rally, according to data from BlackRock Fundamental Equities. There also isn't much of a difference between average stock performance during years in which an election is held and ones without a contest. David Sadkin, a partner at Bel Air Investment Advisors, said he has been asked about the election at almost every meeting he takes with wealthy clients. He said both parties have shown an inclination to spend big, leading to widening U.S. deficits. Treasury issuance has surged, spanning both Trump and Biden's presidency. It's one reason he cautions investors against making a big bet around the outcome. The impact is impossible to predict, Sadkin said. So we'll see. It's a lot of supposition as to how things will play out in the coming months as we lead up to the election and how that will impact the markets. This article is a bit related to the previous article about how the presidential election could impact markets, not only nationally, but perhaps the economies globally. It says Beijing braces for a rematch of Trump versus China. Subtitle is, officials are preparing for the potential of more turbulent U.S. relations and another trade war should Trump get reelected. Last year, as Mike Pompeo's memoir, Never Give an Inch, made the rounds among China's leaders, one passage in particular enraged Xi Jinping. Secretary of State under former President Donald Trump wrote that the U.S. should, quote, grant full diplomatic recognition, close quote, to Taiwan. Xi's anger at the remark foreshadowed a broader worry coursing through Beijing. What awaits China should Trump and his inner circle regain power? Trump's 4 years in the White House had brought turmoil to the relationship. When he left in 2020, Beijing breathed a sigh of relief. Quote, good riddance, Donald Trump, close quote, the official Xinhua news agency said in an unusually expressive tweet. Now Chinese officials are quietly preparing for the prospect of Trump's return to the White House and bracing for the drama in its U.S. relations to amp up again, according to people close to the Chinese leadership's thinking. President Trump has made life difficult for Beijing, too, by keeping in place and even expanding Trump's tough-on-China economic policies and by building up coalitions with U.S. allies to counter China. Yet Biden has also sought to deal back rancor with Beijing, an effort Xi appreciates, the people said. A case in point, Washington took care not to antagonize Beijing around January's presidential election in Taiwan, the self-ruled island that China claims as its own, a matter in which it has repeatedly warned the U.S. not to meddle. Some officials see benefits for China from a potential Trump win in November. In their view, he could accelerate what Xi believes is the U.S.'s decline as the singular world power, cause more political and social disarray in America, and push away allies Biden has won over, potentially helping Beijing rebuild relations with Europe. But overall, they believe the harm of a second Trump term likely would outweigh any potential benefits. The people close to the leadership say much will depend on who would be in Trump's inner circle. Pompeo, who said he's open to joining a second Trump administration, leads a list of 28 former Trump administration officials Beijing put on a sanctions list and banned from entering Chinese territory. The day before Biden took office, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman labeled Pompeo, quote, clown of the century, close quote, for his allegations that China committed genocide against the Uyghur ethnic group in Xinjiang. Trump and his trade war lieutenant, Robert Lighthizer, have openly advocated all but cutting off China's access to America's markets, technology, and capital. The Chinese believe that if Trump returns to the White House, the upside to the U.S.-China relationship would be capped by the but the downside is bottomless, said Yun Sun, director of the China program at the Stimson Center, a Washington think tank. China's foreign ministry said in a statement, whoever is elected as the U.S. president, we hope the U.S. will work with China to promote a bilateral relationship. China opposes some people in the U.S. using China rhetoric for election purposes. Interviews with policy advisors in both capitals, as well as people who have consulted with Chinese officials, gave a picture of preparations in Beijing. Some Chinese ministries, such as those for foreign affairs, trade, investment, and technology, have designated officials to be U.S. election watchers with a focus on the Trump camp. One immediate concern is the potential for another trade war. China's companies are speeding up efforts to expand their access to advanced technologies such as artificial intelligence in regions like the Middle East, worried that a Trump victory could quicken the pace of U.S. tech sanctions against China. Despite calls from U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and others to stop flooding the world's market with cheap goods, China is set on a state-led drive to manufacture its way out of the worst economic headwinds in recent decades. Officials reason that it is best way to outcompete the U.S., especially if Trump returns to the White House. Senior Chinese officials have stepped up their courtship of American business leaders, quizzing them on who they think would be a Trump cabinet, trying to get them to lock in China investments. The Biden years, with wars in Ukraine and Gaza, have seen a deeper demarcation in geopolitics, with, roughly speaking, the U.S. and Europe on one side and China and Russia on the other. A Trump win could muddle that constellation. A big worry for Xi, according to the people close to the leadership, is whether Trump will disrupt his, quote, bromance with Vladimir Putin. When he was in the White House, Trump repeatedly sought to bring the U.S. closer to Russia. Xi has cultivated a personal bond with the Russian leader and fears that if Trump cozies up to Putin, it could weaken Beijing's own relationship with Moscow, a crucial partner in Xi's standoff with the West. Worse, some strategists say Trump could try to pull a, quote, reverse Nixon, much like former Richard Nixon sought China out to counter the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Trump might seek to turn Moscow against Beijing. For now, Washington is focused on reducing Beijing's assistance to Russia. The Biden administration is pressuring China to cut back its support for Russia's defense industry, a message Secretary of State Antony Blinken delivered to Xi and other senior officials on his visit to China last week. Beijing's relations with Washington have entered a period of relative calm since Biden and Xi met in California in November, a summit intended to break a diplomatic impasse after a suspected Chinese spy balloon flew over America last year. As the program was being set for the summit, the Xi team had one wish, that two leaders could take a stroll together. Beijing wanted to beam back to the Chinese public amicable snapshots of Xi with Biden, much like its 2013 summit produced images of Xi and former President Barack Obama leisurely taking a walk to show that their leader had China's most important bilateral relationship under control. The White House accommodated the wish. The four-hour meeting at a woodsy estate outside of San Francisco included a widely televised promenade by the two leaders. The administration has often said it seeks to manage U.S.-China competition responsibly, even though Biden has largely carried out the Trump administration's trade stance. "The Chinese know what they don't like about Biden," said Rick Waters, a former senior China official at the State Department and now managing director for China at Eurasia Group, a political risk consulting firm. "But they do put value in Biden's effort to try to stabilize the relationship." Since the summit, though, despite the establishment of a dozen working groups to restart talks on trade and other policies and a recent phone call between Biden and Xi, there is little negotiation going on. Biden officials say it will take time to get the conversations of a greater substance. In Beijing, a potential Trump victory is also a factor. The Chinese likely think it makes little sense to compromise if the Biden administration is going the way of the dodo bird, said Scott Kennedy, a China expert for the Center of Strategic and International Studies, who recently consulted with officials and government advisors in Beijing. Trump's prize 2016 victory upended the U.S.'s long-standing strategy of deepening economic ties with China. Xi and his initially believed Trump's tough talk masked a fear of Chinese economic strength. When Trump started setting tariffs on China in early 2018 to force Beijing to change its state-led economic practices, Beijing hit back in kind each time, figuring the businessman turned president would eventually back down. Tit-for-tat escalation followed, the American levies on imports of Chinese goods ending up quadrupling from 3% to 12% on average during Trump's first term. Long used to being the more histrionic party in the relationship, China's communist rulers found themselves having to deal with an erratic dealmaker using extreme pressure to extract concessions from Beijing. "Under Trump, we had a bad experience," Liu Zhixiao, a senior party diplomat seen as China's likely next foreign minister, said at a closed-door session with American think tanks earlier this year, according to people who attended the meeting. the economic cost of Beijing of Trump's tariffs retained by Biden is real. Chinese companies slapped with tariffs exported less to the U.S., reduced hiring, spent less on research and development, and were less likely to start new ventures, according to research from economists at Peking University, Fudan University, and other leading Chinese universities. Overall, the damage to China's gross domestic product from the trade war was three times as high as the hit to the U.S., according to some Chinese economists. In Washington, Trump's aggressive stance on China was a hit. A bipartisan consensus has since taken hold that the U.S.'s previous engagement with Beijing had failed in its goal to make China adopt a more market-driven economic approach. Still, Trump's trade war didn't accomplish its main goals. A so-called Phase One trade agreement signed between Washington and Beijing in early 2020 was centered on China's promise to increase purchases of American goods and services by $200 billion over 2 years. According to estimates by the Peterson Institute for International Economics, Beijing fell 40% short of its commitment. The U.S. didn't get the fundamental reforms of China's economic policies it had sought, such as reducing state subsidies that give Chinese companies a leg up on their foreign competitors. For now, a big part of Beijing's planning for a potential return of Trump involves tariffs and advanced technology. Some economic officials are turning to books such as, quote, No Trade is Free by Lighthizer. Trump's trade strategist, who negotiated the Phase One deal with Beijing and who has been floated as a candidate for Treasury Secretary in a second Trump administration. Other Beijing officials are inviting U.S. and other Western experts to scenario planning sessions aimed at gauging the pace and the scope of U.S. export controls should Trump win again. Already, according to a February research study by Jimmy Goodrich, a China and semiconductor industry expert and senior advisor to the RAND Corporation, Chinese government researchers have been trying to deepen cooperation in areas such as biotech, quantum computing, and AI with the Abu Dhabi Technology Innovation Institute. A spokesman at the government-funded institute in the United Arab Emirates, a Middle Eastern ally of Beijing, said it is a global research institute with over 70 partnerships with organizations in 34 countries. Efforts by Beijing to get around U.S. tech sanctions are likely to accelerate in the months ahead, Chinese analysts say. Washington is concerned that Chinese companies could get their hands on powerful AI chips through other foreign entities that buy them from the U.S. Trump has said that if reelected, he might impose tariffs of up to 60% on imports from China. It's unclear how such a move could be carried out. People close to Trump's campaign say that as the presidential race intensifies, Trump likely will try to contrast his gloves-off approach to China with Biden's, which tends to be more targeted. A spokeswoman for the Trump team referred to his past remarks, indicating he would take an aggressive stance if he gets back in power. My agenda will tax China to build up America, Trump said earlier this year. As a matter of both economic and national security, I will implement a bold series of reforms to completely eliminate dependence on China in all critical areas. If Trump gets elected, says Matt Turpin, a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution, who served on Trump's National Security Council, quote, on day one, he would ask how China lived up to the Phase One trade agreement. Then he would instruct Lighthizer to pick up where he left off, close quote. In his book published last year, Lighthizer describes China as the greatest threat that the American nation and the system of Western liberal democratic government has faced since the American Revolution. China has already been shifting its trade away from the U.S. and other developed economies. A report by the McKinsey Global Institute shows that a developing economy, including Russia, accounted for more than half of China's goods trades last year, up from 42% in 2017. In a statement, China's foreign ministry said, the fact has long proven that trade wars and tariff wars are not beneficial to either side. Compared with his stance on trade, Trump has been more ambiguous on Taiwan. Asked by Fox News in early July whether the U.S. should come to Taiwan's defense in a Chinese invasion, Trump said, "If I answer that question, it'll put me in a very bad negotiating position." The remark prompted speculation that Trump would treat the Taiwan issue somewhat like a business deal, potentially using it as a bargain chip in trade negotiations, such as getting China to buy more goods. That approach would likely have limited success with China's leaders, who see Beijing's goal of eventually taking control of China as a sacred mission. "Beijing's view is that Taiwan is ours to begin with," said one China Foreign Affairs advisor. "Why would we write a big check for that?" So, interesting view of the situation as to how it might play out, depending upon whomever is elected. This next is a just an interesting article about the daily life in China in relation to our previous article. It says, "Travel by bike, bring your own cup. China imposes a frugal life on public servants." Subtitle is, "Local Chinese leaders have been looking to cut waste as they heed calls from Beijing to save money." When Chinese Communist Party officials put officials on notice that they must get used to tightening the purse strings for years to come, the response was swift. At least 21 provincial-level governments trimmed their budgets for official vehicles this year. The governor of Guangzhou province pledged to cut his administration's operating expenses by 15%. An official in the central province of Hunan urged colleagues to become, quote, "red housekeepers," close quote, who honor the party's revolutionary roots by ensuring cost-efficient governance. No penny was too small to pinch. One statistics bureau in the southern province of Hunan told staff not to set thermostats below 26 degrees Celsius or 79 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer. Authorities in Inner Mongolia said government agencies should minimize the purchase of new equipment by repairing and reusing items such as desks, chairs, and computers. The southwestern city of Yibin asked officials to print routine documents on lower quality paper. China's local government finances have been creaking under heavy debts for years, but 3 years of zero tolerance efforts to contain the COVID-19 pandemic depleted state coffers in many areas. China's post-COVID economic hangover and slumping property market exacerbated the problem by driving down land sale revenues that many localities depend on. In recent months, two major credit ratings firms downgraded their outlooks on China's credit rating to negative from stable. The scope of the belt tightening reflects the extent to which China's new economic realities have reverberated across the country. Tepid growth and a weaker job market have buffeted a swath of the population, from ordinary people to government workers, and forced many to adjust doing more with less. Chinese leader Xi Jinping first launched the frugality campaign in 2019 as part of a push to curb government waste. Beijing ramped up the effort in December, telling officials to embrace belt tightening for the long haul. Party and government agencies must get used to living frugally, said the readout from the party's annual economic policy conclave. Such exhortations soon proliferated in party and state media messaging, which called on cadres to pay attention to the leadership's use of the term Xi Wang, or, quote, "getting used to," close quote. Living frugally isn't a temporary need or a tactic of expedience, but a principle of policy that must be adhered to for a long time. The party's top disciplinary agency, which Xi has used to enforce compliance with his policies, said in January, quote, "spend every penny on crucial areas and spend it to the maximum effect." In recent weeks, many local governments have issued detailed directives on how to get used to living frugally, telling staff to save money by using public transport, buying cheaper stationery, and printing documents in black and white and on both sides of the paper. Others ordered bureaucrats to finish their food, cut back on work trips, as well as repair and reuse hardware from official cars to office furniture. Beijing also tightened controls over infrastructure spending in highly indebted regions and lowered its budget deficit target to 3% of gross domestic product for this year, down from 3.8% last year. In a show of the government's commitment to fiscal discipline, those efforts were put into place as needed. While the belt tightening isn't likely to significantly alleviate fiscal pressures, the messaging serves as a political purpose. It's just performative. They are talking about small things when they should be focused on fixing the big things, such as getting local governments to raise revenues and reduce debt, said Christine Wong, an expert on Chinese public finance and a visiting professor of the National University of Singapore's East Asian Institute. You're talking about saving a few billion here and there, which are trifling amounts compared with the Chinese government's annual general public budget of about 28 trillion yuan, she said, equivalent to about $3.9 trillion. The frugality campaign is essentially an admission that money is tight, Wong said. It's also saying that the public sector is sharing in the pain. Everybody is earning less money and having to do with less. Senior officials and state media have reinforced the message with appeals to patriotism, telling public servants that frugality amounts to loyalty and the savings will help fund projects that benefit ordinary people and propel China forward. The goal is to scrimp on routine expenses so that the government can, quote, concentrate financial firepower to do big things, said Chinese Finance Minister Lo Fan, told reporters in March. Every penny that the party and government agencies save is one more penny that can be spent on people's livelihoods. Later that month, the finance ministry issued guidance urging government agencies to tighten control over spending and track their finances more closely. For example, officials should rein in costs related to overseas travel, vehicular transport, and official receptions and meetings, such as by convening meetings online rather than in person and using government facilities rather than commercial venues, the ministry said. Party authorities have also played up frugality as a culture and revolutionary tradition. The party's disciplinary agency has cited party lore on the simple lives of past leaders, noting Mao Zedong reportedly had his pajamas patched up to 73 times, while another revolutionary elder, Chen Yun, used the same suitcase for 62 years. The central government also hopes the austerity campaign can help curb the moral hazard that stems from efforts to bail out heavily indebted regions and avoid a broader financial crisis, experts say. Beijing is telling local governments, quote, that they should first and foremost rely on themselves, close quote, said Tenli Huang, a research fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. Many localities are very good at wasting money because they, for a long time, were not subject to any hard budgetary constraints, Huang says. In practice, though, the quest for frugality has often devolved into nickel and diming on routine expenses as cadres race to demonstrate compliance with the campaign. At one state-owned ironworks in Yunnan, party officials urged employees to reduce annual expenses on drinking water by 30% from last year's total of 270,000 yuan. Strictly control the consumption of bottled water in each work unit, the plant's party committee said in a notice, encouraging employees to bring their own cups rather than disposable ones. China's agency that oversees the state procurement and logistics, the National Government Offices Administration, recommended recycling office waste and reminding staff to save electricity and water. The supply of disposable office supplies such as paper and pencils must be controlled, Lin Li, an official in the administration, wrote in a recent article. One county in the northern region of Inner Mongolia proposed, quote, green, close quote, transportation guidelines to cut down on the use of official vehicles, encouraging encouraging government workers to walk distances up to 1 kilometer, 6/10 of a mile, ride bicycles when traveling between 2 kilometers and 5 kilometers, and take public transport for longer distances. Such measures will yield only modest savings, and quote, in the grand scheme of things, this does not matter that much, according to Wang. The government must still find ways to put money to better use, he said. Officials say they want to do, quote, big things with these savings, but what are those big things, Huang said. I don't think there's a very clear definition. So even belt tightening in a socialistic country needs to be done periodically. Well, it's not strictly regarding China. Elon Musk's recent decision to shut down its entire one division of Tesla does have an impact on China. But the title of the article is Why Musk Now Needs China More Than It Needs Him. The subtitle is Beijing Seeks to Score Political Points as It Hands Tesla a Victory. Elon Musk's whistle-stop trip to Beijing for an audience with Chinese Premier Li Wang highlighted how the power dynamic is shifting between Tesla and the Chinese government. Tesla's chief executive left the country with assurances that the carmaker will be able to roll out its driver assistance technology. The software underpins Musk's hopes for rekindling Tesla's growth in the world's biggest electric vehicle market, where it is being outmaneuvered by homegrown rivals. China, meanwhile, used his trip to promote its message that it is open to American businesses, despite rising tensions with the U.S. state media quoted Musk giving a stamp of approval to Chinese EV market, saying his comments dispelled U.S. concerns over capacity. Beijing also sought to show that foreign firms can thrive under the tight regulatory controls over data. Musk emerged with a win, analysts said, but the meetings underscored that while China remains crucial to Tesla, Beijing now needs Tesla less to spice up its EV and autonomous driving industry. Tesla has seen Chinese sales fall as its rivals there flood the market with hundreds of new models, contributing to the American carmaker's first year-over-year quarterly sales decline since 2020 and a sharp profit drop. China needed Tesla to open the EV market. I'm not sure China needs Tesla to open the market for autonomous vehicles, said Bill Russo, a Shanghai-based consultant for automobility. Some Chinese companies are already capable of sophisticating driving technology on their own, he said. Chinese officials faded Musk when he went to China in the early years of their relationship. They offered land, low-interest loans, and tax incentives for Tesla to build a factory in Shanghai, and its approval boosted consumers' perception of Tesla in the world's biggest auto market. Then, Premier Li Qiang even took a Tesla for a spin within the gated community of Zhongnanhai Leadership Compound in 2019. The deal worked out well for both sides. Tesla helped ignite China's EV industry, which is now the envy of the world. Shanghai became Tesla's most productive and cost-efficient factory, enabling it to lower the prices of its cars. Sales of Tesla's made-in-China Model 3 and Model Y soared, making the country its second biggest market, as well as an export hub. But Chinese carmakers inspired by Tesla have become fierce rivals, gobbling up its market share there and increasingly challenging it overseas. Expectations among many analysts that Tesla would expand its Shanghai factory to manufacture a more affordable EV have dimmed. Instead, a plot of land adjacent to its initial plant is being used by Tesla to produce its energy storage megapacks. Workers at the car factory say operating hours were cut to 5 days a week from 7 in March as it wasn't running at full capacity. When talking about plans for Tesla's full self-driving, or FSD, features during a call to discuss the company's dismal earnings last week, Musk said Tesla would release the service, quote, in any market that, where we can get regulatory approval for that, which we think includes China, close quote. Days later, he flew to Beijing to seek Chinese leaders' blessing. During the less than 24-hour visit, Chinese regulators also gave Tesla's cars clearance for data that they collect on the road, potentially paving the way for the government to loosen bans on the vehicles going to sensitive sites such as military complexes and some government buildings. Musk has agreed to deal with China's Baidu for its FSD rollout, reassuring Chinese leaders over the security risks of Chinese user data. Pushing toward Tesla's FSD in China is of strategic value to Beijing, which aspires to build itself as a global data leader, said Feng Shusheng, founding partner of Hutong Research. This will be much desired for Beijing to prove that its data regulatory regime is gaining traction. Chinese state television showed the meeting between Li and Musk. Li, previously the Communist Party's chief in Shanghai, when Tesla was setting up its production facilities there, called Musk his, quote, old friend, and Musk's three-year-old son a handsome little boy during their meeting. The encounter marked a contrast to the grillings the CEO of Chinese company-owned TikTok has received during appearances before lawmakers in Washington. It also came days after President Biden passed a law ordering the video sharing app's U.S. operations to be sold or face a ban. Li used Sunday's meeting with Musk to signal to foreign businesses that the government is welcoming their presence at a time when foreign direct investments are falling. China's huge market is always open to foreign businesses. China does what it promises, Li said, according to a government readout of the meeting. China is committed to offering a better business environment, allowing foreign corporations to feel safe about investing in China, he added. Global Times, a nationalistic Communist Party-backed newspaper, said in an article that China's current EV capacity has been jointly forged by both Chinese and foreign companies in response to U.S. claims that China had a problem with EV overcapacity. State media commentary highlighted Musk's comment Sunday that all cars would be electric in the future. Based on what Musk said, not only is there no overcapacity, it is far from sufficient, the commentary said. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned against industrial overcapacity in China during a visit to Beijing in early April, and the Biden administration has mooted restrictions on Chinese cars over national security concerns related to the data they collect. The European Union is considering imposing tariffs on Chinese cars as it investigates state EV subsidies. Musk has often been a dependable ally to Beijing. He has publicly praised its ruling Communist Party and China's economic miracle. Musk was rebuked by the government of Taiwan after he described the self-ruled island as China's equivalent of Hawaii, with Taiwan's foreign ministry suggesting that the Tesla CEO had sold himself to Beijing. Musk traveled to China a week after he postponed a trip to India, another of China's geopolitical rivals, where he was expected to meet Indian Premier Narendra Modi and unveil plans for Tesla's entry to the country. Investors saw the China trip as a success, sending Tesla shares up 16% Monday. Whether the latest blessing from Beijing will reverse Tesla's sliding fortunes in the country remains to be seen. Tesla is stuck with two aging mass-market EV vehicle models, despite a recent refresh of the introduction of the Cybertruck, which hasn't yet been released in China. Still, the endorsement from a top Chinese official could spur new sales for the U.S. carmaker, said Russo, the auto consultant. So we'll see how that whole market evolves, since the majority of those products are being made in China. And we'll see how the competition works out from that. Our final article today, we'll try to leave on a little bit of a humorous note. It says the most dreaded word at work, colon, and in quotations, hey, H-E-Y. why the exploding use of the one-word instant message to get your attention is driving people crazy. Harrison Longman's three-letter message missives strike fear into the hearts of his colleagues at the Lucky General's ad agency in New York. "My mind goes to the worst places," says Athena Hasbany, a 31-year-old account director who works with Lutrong, a creative director. "There is no other information in the Slack instant message as she waits for the proverbial other shoe to drop. It's like, am I fired? Am I in trouble? Is your mom okay?" The hey and wait instant message phenomenon comes in other iterations. They are hi, hi there, hi hi, hiya, or heyo, but the effect is the same. While the quick drop salutation is often innocuous, it can leave recipients fearing the worst, or it can feel like a trap. It's a friendly tone masking that something else is being added to your already lengthy to-do list. It also has a name, hey hanging. The hey might arrive on Slack, Microsoft Teams, or Google Chat, or over text. Brian Robinson, a psychotherapist and author of a book on hybrid work, said the word can engage a fight or flight response. The brain has to know, quote, what's going on for survival, he says, and it often jumps to the worst case scenario. Our minds go, I'm in hot water. For Hasbany, follow-ups to Longren's recent hey messages included a request for a link to a presentation and a question about when she'd be in the office so they could collaborate. While Hasbany doesn't report to Longren, where he is more senior and can kill ideas or kick concepts back for additional work, raising the stakes of his ambiguous readings. If it's a plain hey or hi, I'm going down a terrible rabbit hole, she says. Longtran, who is 42, says in his defense that a lot of his coworkers are younger. Apparently, there are a lot of rules, he says. As workers feel pressure to do more at a faster clip, employees and bosses expect quick answers from colleagues, even when they're not together. That dynamic has supercharged real-time conversations online. Instant messaging is, quote, the Red Bull of communication, said Tracy Brady, senior vice president of communications for a cannabis company. It's that back and forth, you and me, right now, how do I get you to pay attention? Employees spend nearly 90% of their work week communicating across multiple channels, according to a 2023 Harris Poll survey of more than 1,200 workers and executives. One in four said they experience miscommunication multiple times a day, according to the report conducted on behalf of proofreading software company Grammarly. Fiona Tulip, a brand strategist and marketing consultant in New York, knows the drill whenever she receives a message from Robin Malone, who runs her own public relations agency in Chicago. The two sometimes collaborate on projects for the same client. To get her friend's attention, Malone has a tendency to text hey, H-E-Y, to Tulip without further information. It drives me batty, Tulip said. She started taking screenshots of the hey hanging offenses and several weeks ago brought it up in casual conversation about work. Tulip shared her photos, including a hey, written at 1:10 p.m. on a Monday. Tulip refused to respond until she got more information. Malone's next note finally came at 2:28. Hey, want to get you involved in a project? What's your rate? Malone defends hay hanging as a way to ease someone's day. It's kind of rude to jump into someone's text and word vomit whatever I want, she says, but now I'm seeing it's a thing that people don't necessarily love. Corporate communicators say part of the problem is that instant messaging forums at work are still relatively new. Microsoft says its heaviest users now send and receive about 150 chats a day, gaining on the more than 250 emails a day they receive. Slack says 700 million messages are now sent across its channel each day. Discord is increasingly used among friends groups at work. Unlike emails, which generally are longer and don't require an immediate response, instant messaging carries the weight of a real-time back and forth. And while workers have fine-tuned their email protocol, Avoiding all caps, strange fonts, and unnecessarily reply alls, workplace instant messaging is still the Wild West. So what's the right response? There doesn't seem to be any clear etiquette about how to converse anymore, said Kate Buchanan, who helps lead workforce innovation initiatives for software company Autodesk. Still, she admits to writing hi or hey to colleagues from time to time, then getting distracted or not needing the information and leaving them hanging. After what felt like a constant threat of hey hanging at work in recent weeks, Madison Kana, a senior software engineer in the healthcare department at Walmart, reached out for advice on X. Someone messages you hi in Slack/Discord. What is the right response? Some respondents suggested she not reply. Others felt it wasn't such a big offense. A few pointed to a simple website, nohello.net, which has a few tips with a plea. Please don't say just hello in chat. Just ask the question, adds the site. When colleagues communicate in a way that feels irksome, it's important to let them know how it makes them feel, says Constant Hanley, a professor at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. You can say, I was in the middle of deep work when you pinged me, hey, she said. Even if hey is your love language, other people are not receiving it that way. So I didn't realize that the word hey is a form of communications with people, but then I'm naive to lots of things that go on in business these days. Well, that brings an end to our Wall Street Journal report today. Again, this is Dennis at the website or email box 3030. Let me know if there's anything I can do to make this better for you. I'm happy to custom fit this to whatever your needs would be and do whatever I can. So with that, I'll wish you a great week. Take care of yourselves, and we'll talk again soon.